It's hard to say why someone is successful or not successful. But Stephen has all of the mental capacities and the film chops to make successful movies. I think he understands human emotion very well. And he understands dramatic construction, and he understands cinema. And if he chooses to do a popular film, it will likely be very successful. If he chooses to do something with a different kind of ambition, then Stephen is secure enough, I think, to let the chips fall where they may.
If I've changed so much, my wife is even going to recognize me whenever it is I get back to her. And how I'll ever be able to tell her about days like today. Ryan, I don't know anything about Ryan. I don't care. Man means nothing to me. It's just a name. But if... you know, if going to Rommel and finding him so he can go home, if that earns me the right to get back to my wife, well, then that's my mission.
Steven Spielberg, luckily now, is being given the respect that he deserves as a filmmaker who wants to tell the story that he's set out to tell. And no matter how gruesome, no matter how terrifying, no matter how fantastic or magical it should be, it will be as honest as he can create it. And I think that's what makes him extraordinary, is that he does it each time in a completely different genre.
His ability to focus and his... on the set and get what he wants really has everything else falls to the wayside. The only thing he knows is the sun is going down and he doesn't have the shots that he needs, and you have to keep up with him.
Steven Spielberg once was quoted as saying, "I feel I'm all over my movies. I know all my movies are all over me." The cinematic mind of Steven Spielberg has created some of cinema's most entertaining and memorable films, from Jaws to Saving Private Ryan. As a filmmaker, Spielberg has directed, produced, or executive produced 7 of the 20 top-grossing films of all time, including Jurassic Park and E.T. the Extraterrestrial. Worldwide, his films have grossed more than any other filmmaker before him, and at the rate his career continues, that record will most likely hold for many years to come. Born on December 18, 1946, in Cincinnati, Ohio, Spielberg was raised in the suburbs of Haddonfield, New Jersey, and Scottsdale, Arizona. He started making amateur films while still in his teens. His desire to tell stories, as he will readily tell you, began very early in life.
I love ghost stories. I've always loved them. And I used to frighten my sisters with them. I used to frighten myself with them. And I just like telling ghost stories, and it's fun around the campfire when it's, you know, the only light is the lights on your faces, and if you take a few steps back, it's pitch black. Without a flashlight, you can't see your way back to your tent. And it was always fun thinking I'd tell a really scary story, and everybody would be so scared going back to the tents, and I wound up not frightening them as much as I frightened myself. I keep myself up awake. I turn my flashlight on. I just have a night light until the batteries went to yellow and then disappeared, you know, and I'd have no light at all. I would always wind up frightening myself more than other people. The very earliest memory that I recall that associates itself to filmmaking was this urgent need to not be punished by my parents for wrecking my Lionel train set. They would break sometimes, and my dad got frustrated one day, and he said to me, "If I have to take one of these trains one more time back to the Lionel shop to get repaired, I'm taking the entire train set away from you. That's the end." And I remember trying to figure out, well, how can I, like, have this thrill of the great train wreck and not be deprived of my train. So I borrowed his little 8mm movie camera, and I actually filmed the train wreck. And all the cuts, which I didn't really understand what I was doing, but it was sort of intuitively, I knew that if one train went left to right, and the second train, another cut went right to left, and they both met in the middle with the third cut, it's pretty much what I used to do when I used to stick my eye down within an inch above the tracks to get the perspective of the trains going by when I was playing with my train set. And I did that on film. It didn't wreck the trains too bad, but I was able to run the film over and over again, and I really believe that was the first time I realized the power of film, you know, to be able to get away with something and not get punished for it.
His grips, his DP, his costumes, everybody is doing their own passion. And so I think you just sort of like, if I can use this analogy, you come under the umbrella of his, because the collaborative effort of making film is pretty much personified by Steven Spielberg.
In 1969, Spielberg's 22-minute short film, Amblin, was shown at the Atlanta Film Festival, which led to his becoming the youngest director ever to be signed to a long-term deal with a major Hollywood studio. It was at Universal Studios that Spielberg began to learn his craft under the watchful eye of Universal executive Sid Sheinberg. Up until that time, and prior to Amblin, Spielberg had made a number of amateur films that included The Last Gun, Escape to Nowhere, and Firelight, which received a public screening and actually earned its meager production cost back. Spielberg began his professional career at Universal with an episode of the television series Rod Serling's Night Gallery in 1969. The episode starred screen legend Joan Crawford.
I later found out that she was offended that George Seton or Henry Hathaway or one of these, you know, great veteran directors had not been, you know, hired to direct her. But she hid that from me, and I think that it taught me a great lesson that all those actors and actresses that came out of the 1930s and 40s were so professionally raised and trained, the habits were so professional, that she had to look upon me as her director, not as some kid out of a Sid Sheinberg white elephant sale, which is what I often felt that I was, because Sid gave me my break and assigned me to direct Joan Crawford when I was a kid. And she was great, but it was later in the show that it became just a mess. The show kind of got away from me. You know, I had never worked with a professional crew before. I became 2-3 days over schedule. The producer, Bill Sackheim, showed up on the set, began making changes over my shoulder, and it didn't end well. But she was always great, and she was always, you know, highly respectful of the office of director, if not the director himself.
4 years after joining Universal Studios, Spielberg directed the suspenseful telefilm Duel, starring Dennis Weaver. He had seen a short story in Playboy magazine upon which Duel was based, and learned that it was soon to become an ABC Movie of the Week. He pursued the project vigorously and was given the assignment to direct. But Duel would not prove to be an easy task, since Spielberg was only given a 14-day shooting schedule.
One of the things I did was, instead of doing storyboards, I basically had a roadmap of the entire screenplay. And this roadmap was simply to acquaint me in intimate detail with all the twists and turns of the story and all the events that Richard Matheson had put in his teleplay. I know I used 5-6 cameras sometimes, not just on the crash at the end of the story with the truck going into the ravine, but 5-6 cameras just simply, because in 14 days there was no time to really shoot a movie. And those 6 cameras were like a relay race. I would just put the cameras on different sides of the road and have the truck and the car pass those cameras, and then I was able to rob Peter to pay Paul. And it was amazing how it all came together, because I had 6 film editors working on it, because I had an air date of 3 weeks after the last shot. It was supposed to be on ABC 3 weeks hence. It was crazy. So 6 editors were hired, and I was literally running from editing room to editing room, supervising the edit of my little film. And I've never worked as hard, I've never worked as fast, and yet for some strange reasons I miss, looking back, never having worked as fast or as hard on anything else except for Duel.
Spielberg directed 7 more television movies for Universal before seeing a newspaper article with the title Modern Day Bonnie and Clyde, the story of a Texas couple on the run from the law. Together with friends Hal Barwood and Matthew Robbins, he created a screenplay that eventually became the 1974 film Sugarland Express. It would be Spielberg's feature film debut as a director, but only after promising the executives at Universal that he would cast at least one name actor in the film.
And that took it to Sid Sheinberg, and Sid said, well, look, I'm in charge of TV. You need to take this to Jennings Lang, who was in charge of movies at the time. So I brought it to Jennings, who I didn't know very well. And he read the script and liked it. But he said to me, look, I can't give you the shot at directing this movie unless you put a movie star. And it's your choice. You've got 3 characters in the police car, and any one of them, needs to be a movie star. So you go out and either find Lou Jean or the cop or the husband. And if you score a movie star, we'll make the picture with you. Kid. I think he added that at the end of it. And then Dick Sanik and David Brown, who came onto the project to help me get it made, because I wasn't making any headway, they kind of liked the script, and they came on, and they took over the producing of it, and they suggested Goldie Hawn. I went to her house one day and met with her. She loved the character, Lou Jean Poplin, had a lot of great ideas about it, had some changes she wanted me to make, which we did. And then she said yes, and no sooner than Goldie said yes do we have a start date. It was just amazing.
What they're saying is that one doesn't fit.
You broke out of pre-release?
Oh, shut up, mind your own business.
You broke your husband out of pre-release?
Well, you're assuming an awful lot for a man your size.
Who's that, an unemployed beautician? You've been taking money from Dunahide?
No, I quit.
You got $65, you ain't never seen work. What you been doing 3 weeks? You been running around?
I have not.
You're lying.
I am not lying.
Don't lie to me.
Don't you call me no liar. Dunahide and Bill Fass ain't running around. That's just Barron.
I wanted to be successful. And everybody said, you know, with an ending like that, it's not going to be successful, where the husband gets killed and the cop gets away and the wife is destitute and going back to jail and she never gets her child. And how are you going to make any money on this? I guess about 4 months before the film was about to be released, I had this tremendous change of mind. I said, you know, I want a hit. I really want a hit. Maybe all these studio pundits are right. And I went to Dick and David and I said, let's change the ending. They get across the Rio Grande. They get to Mexico. They get away. She gets her baby back. It's a happy ending. And Dick and David said, look, we're artists. We want this movie to end the way your great script ended. You know, it's got to end that way. And they kind of, you know, reminded me that, you know, that I shouldn't cop out and sell out. And I always love them for that. You know, for sort of my last, and in my moment of weakness, they kind of, you know, put some backbone into me again.
With the 1975 release of Jaws, Spielberg's life would never be the same again. He was off and running as one of Hollywood's premier and most bankable film directors. The film starred Roy Scheider, Robert Shaw, and Richard Dreyfuss, and became the first movie to break the $100 million mark and gained for Spielberg a Golden Globe nomination for his direction. But the film was not without its problems, and stories are legendary about production delays and heavy cost overruns due to an uncooperative mechanical shark.
I was meeting on the cut of Sugarland with Dick Sanik and David Brown, and I noticed this pile of papers in their secretary's office, and it said Jaws on the cover. It turned out to be Galleys from the as yet unpublished novel by Peter Benchley. And I remember asking if I could read it, and Dick and David said, well, you can read it, but there's another director on it already. I said, that's okay, this looks interesting. And, you know, Jaws, I thought it was a story about dental work. I didn't know. You know, it was about the ocean and the shark. So I took it to my house and I read it over the weekend and I flipped out for it. I just went nuts, especially the last 150 pages, which was the hunt, the sea hunt for this great white leviathan, you know. And it reminded me of Duel, because Duel is about this kind of unknown force chasing this innocent bystander. So I really was relating to that material, and it was a part of my life, and that story was still fresh in my mind. And I said to Dick and David, if anything ever falls out with this director that you've hired, I'll do the picture. And one day they called me and they said, the director fell out, it's yours.
He'd done the television movie Duel, and then he did Sugarland Express, and certainly we knew that this young man could direct. But Jaws was a huge, huge undertaking and very expensive for that day. And I was impressed that he was cool enough under pressure to take the time that he needed to make sure the actors were believable and interesting in the movie. And that certainly paid off.
Give me your hands. Dogfish. You got a $5,000 net. You got $2,000 worth of fishing, and along comes Mr. Whitey. By the time he's finished with that net,
looks like a kiddie scissor class has cut it up for a paper doll.
You got city hands, Mr. Hooper. You've been counting money all your life.
All right. Hey, I don't need this. I don't need this working class hero crap.
You're not going to do this aboard the ship, are you, Mr. Quinn?
Maybe I should go alone.
No, it's my party. It's my charter.
Yeah, it's your charter. It's your party. It's my vessel. And you're on board my vessel, mate, master, pilot, and I'm captain. Take him for ballast, chief. You got him.
There were many days, where I'd just spent many days sitting on the shark barge waiting for the effects to be ready for me to go to work and direct the picture. And, wondering, was this film going to end my career? Was I going to have to end my career on the water, which I didn't like anyway? And, would I ever work again? I mean, those thoughts came to mind all the time, that we were just at the mercy of the forces of nature and the forces of technology, which is what that shark was. He was a technological marvel, but it also didn't work that well.
And my memories of him sitting on the camera boat, watching and waiting for that thing to work, I know it was very exasperating for him and for the studio. But in a way, I think we were blessed.
And forced me into a lot of compromising positions, but they were all good compromises because the film is actually scarier, I've often said, because the shark didn't work that well. And with the absence of the shark, I had just the ocean and the kind of power of suggestion to allow the audience to imagine where you weren't actually seeing the shark. And I think that really amped up the suspense of that picture tenfold.
When I'm in the boat alone and the boat is sinking, and I'm left there with the shark and my rifle, and the boat is going down. It was a balsa wood boat. Well, I'm getting inside the boat, and the stuntman is handing me an axe, a hammer, and a chisel, and the rifle. And I said, what is all this for? He says, well, we've never sunk this boat before. And if the windows and the doors don't open, this is so you can fight your way out. I said, oh, okay. So as soon as that boat started to go down, I moved very quickly to get the hell out of there.
I had no idea what we had made. And it was only after I previewed it the first time in Dallas, Texas, that I saw that audience, who had never been on my production, had never had to fight the weather, had never had to deal with the growing pains of getting that movie made, they just came to it kind of blindsided with a little help from the book, which was a huge bestseller by that time. And they just ate the movie up. And that was the first time I realized that we might have something here.
Once again, Spielberg teamed up with actor Richard Dreyfuss for the 1977 blockbuster, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Hard as it may be to comprehend, no one would initially listen to Stephen's idea for Close Encounters until Jaws became an unqualified worldwide hit.
Damn it, I know this. I know what this is. This means something. This is important.
Well, I have been trying to make Close Encounters of the Third Kind even before Jaws, and nobody would give me a meeting. They wouldn't read my treatment. They wouldn't hear my ideas about a UFO project until Jaws was this big hit. And then suddenly I discovered what a hit can do for a filmmaker, as it can for a writer or a producer or an actor or an actress. And I fortunately had something I was passionate about making after Jaws, and it was very easy getting the money from Columbia once Jaws, you know, got our foot in the door. And Firelight was the inspiration for Close Encounters, as was just my keen interest on the whole subject of outer space and, you know, the chance that there's life off this planet, and the chance that there might have been life from out there coming here at some time or another. And so I was very keenly interested in those subjects. And I had a lot to say about with Close Encounters of the Third Kind, but I was very careful not to say it so loud that the message would drown out the fact that this was also and supposed to be an entertainment. Wanted to make was the movie that came out with the special edition, because I didn't have time to finish Close Encounters. The effects took a long time. I was unhappy with my first cut. I talked Columbia into letting me, you know, write and direct five sequences, not just inserts as we often do when we finish a movie. We fix things with inserts and a line of dialogue here or there. I shot five huge scenes, including the discovery of Flight 19, those TBM Avenger fighter bombers at the beginning of the movie in the California desert. I mean, that was all added after I saw my first cut and didn't like the way the film originally opened with air traffic control. And now I've got, I think, the best balance on the laser, and someday on the DVD, which is the best balance between the original film and the special edition. I've cut out the ending. You no longer see the inside of the ship, and it's kind of a hybrid of both pictures.
Writer-director Robert Zemeckis and writer Bob Gale wrote Spielberg's next film, the 1979 release of 1941, starring John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd. Unfortunately, 1941 did not enjoy either the critical or box office success of Jaws or Close Encounters of the Third Kind. But along came George Lucas with an idea for a film titled Raiders of the Lost Ark, which was released in 1981. The film would capture the imagination of audiences worldwide. Spielberg was quoted as saying, "I made it as a B-movie. I didn't see the film as anything more than a better-made version of the Republic Picture series." Lucas and Spielberg followed up the initial Raiders film with two successful sequels, Indiana Jones and The Temple of Doom in 1984.
Don't you?
No, do you?
And Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade in 1989. Both films went on to overwhelming box office success, and there is continuing talk between Lucas and Spielberg for yet another one.
Junior?
Yes, sir.
It is you, Junior. Don't call me that, please.
Well, the trilogy of Indiana Jones films began with a casual walk on a beach in Hawaii.
Well, I was vacationing with George in Hawaii the week that Star Wars opened in 1977, in May. And George just simply asked me what I was going to do next. And I said, I'm trying to get a meeting with Cubby Broccoli. I'm trying to get him to let me do a James Bond picture, which I had always wanted to direct Bond. And George said, don't waste your time, I have a better idea. It's called Raiders of the Lost Ark. And he told me this very complicated story about this archaeologist and his search for antiquities and all these kind of supernatural antiquities. And George didn't have much more except that concept and a couple of paintings that this guy named John Steranko, this artist, had done of Indiana Jones with the leather jacket and the fedora hat and all that and the whip. And that was about it, but I just flipped out for the idea, and we shook hands and made a deal on the beaches of Hawaii to do three pictures if the first one succeeded, and we began.
Nose,
seems to me, the whole history of film, and there's hardly a movie you can mention where he doesn't have some understanding of it or some knowledge of it. And sometimes that can be very interesting. I remember one time we were doing a scene in the second Indiana Jones involving elephants, and we rehearsed it once or twice, and then Steven said, okay, let's take those the pointy sticks away from the mahouts. And all the mahouts said, no, we can't control the elephants without the pointy sticks. And Steven said, no, come on, don't tell me that. I've never seen the pointy sticks. Remember Jungle Book? They didn't have the pointy sticks in Jungle Book. So Steven's idea of elephants had come from Jungle Book.
In 1982, Spielberg captured the hearts and minds of moviegoers with the release of E.T. the Extraterrestrial. Primarily populated by a group of kids, the film was pure fantasy entertainment that appealed to people of all ages. The movie reflected Spielberg's interest in outer space, but instead of a standard UFO fantasy adventure, he fashioned a film that told a heartwarming story of an endearing alien, primarily through the eyes of children. E.T. became the Wizard of Oz of its time and remains timeless in its storytelling techniques that allows enthusiastic audiences to watch and enjoy the film time and time again.
E.T. phone home. And they'll come.
Come. Home. Home.
My inspiration for E.T. was my interest in, you know, in outer space and UFOs and the divorce of my mom and dad, which I think is what E.T. essentially is about. When I was shooting the scene Close Encounters, I had actually, shooting the last scene, I had thought about E.T. and thought about what it would be like to tell a story about a single alien who comes into the life of a young boy whose father has left his mother, and somewhat the special friend fills that void. I feel like I am a kid, so I think I relate to kids really well. And I talk to kids like I would talk to you. I've talked to friends of mine. I talk to kids like they're kids. I think the whole idea of giving kids their equal due and giving them a lot of respect for being people, not don't be prejudiced because they're children. And I think that, and also allowing them to have a say in the characters they're playing, allowing them to mix their own language in with the language of the writer. So many of the wonderful lines from E.T., albeit written by Melissa Matheson and wonderfully written by her, other lines came from Drew Barrymore and Henry Thomas and Robert McNaught, and just from that zeitgeist the kids bring to to a film.
Elliot, look what I did to you.
In 1985, Spielberg released The Color Purple, based on the novel by Alice Walker. The film followed the life of Celie, played by Whoopi Goldberg, a young black girl growing up in the early 1900s. Beautifully photographed, sensitively directed, with an outstanding cast that included Danny Glover and Oprah Winfrey, the film received critical acclaim from such critics as Roger Ebert of the Chicago Sun-Times, who wrote, "The affirmation at the end of the film is so joyous that this is one of the few movies in a long time that inspires tears of happiness and earns them." Spielberg was awarded the Directors Guild Award for Outstanding Directorial Achievement. The film also received a nomination from the Academy Awards as Best Picture. Spielberg's next film was the 1987 release of Empire of the Sun, based on J.B. Ballard's semi-autobiographical novel. It is the story of a boy, played by Christian Bale, whose life is upturned when he becomes separated from his parents during the Japanese invasion of Shanghai. The National Board of Review presented Spielberg with the NBR Award as Best Director. Interestingly enough, director David Lean had shown an original interest in making Empire of the Sun, but later convinced Spielberg that he should direct it himself.
He was probably one of the greatest influences on my entire career. I mean, I've seen his films numerous times. I've studied them from Breaking the Sound Barrier, you know, right through, Passage to India. And so when he called me up, he asked me for a favor. I couldn't believe David Lean's asking me for a favor. And he said, there's a book I read called Empire of the Sun that I fancy directing. Can you get me some information on who has the book? And so I made some phone calls and discovered that my good friend Terry Semel, who was head of Warner Brothers, it was his project. And that there had actually been a screenplay written by Tom Stoppard. But there was a director assigned to the project. And so I had to call David Lean back, give him the bad news that it was unavailable. It was already spoken for. And then about 8-9 months later, Terry Semel called me and said, the director that we had on the project is no longer doing the film. Do you want to give it to your friend David Lean? So I called David back. I couldn't wait to get him on the telephone. I said, David, Empire of the Sun is available again. The script is done. It's free. I'm sending it to you. And David said, no, don't bother. You know, he said, you know, I spent 8-9 months thinking about it, and there's other things I want to move on to, and plus the fact I think I'm too old to work with children. He said, you should do it. I said, no. He said, you should do this project. And he proceeded to talk me into directing this movie. And that's exactly how it happened.
In his third outing with Spielberg, Richard Dreyfuss starred in Always as Ace Force fighting pilot Pete Sandich, who loses his life while piloting an aircraft over a raging fire.
How much fuel you got left?
Come on, I want to blow out this one tree, funny face.
Negative, Sandich. Get out of the sky.
The tale was based on A Guy Named Joe, a 1942 romance starring Spencer Tracy.
Oh, yes, you'll see. He'll crow, he'll fight, he'll fly, and then... you'll die.
In 1991, Spielberg retold the story of Peter Pan in the film Hook, based on James M. Barrie's play and starring Dustin Hoffman and Robin Williams. In Hook, Peter Pan has grown up to be a cutthroat merger and acquisitions lawyer. As perfect a fit as it might have initially appeared for Spielberg's ability to tell wonderful stories about children, the film was not well received. Spielberg would take the cinema world by storm once again with the 1993 release of Jurassic Park, based on the Michael Crichton novel. The film brought a new meaning to the term computer graphics as dinosaurs easily intermingled with live actors. So successful was Jurassic Park that a sequel, Jurassic Park: The Lost World, was released in 1997. For The Lost World, Spielberg received the Rembrandt Award as Best Director.
Michael Crichton and I were in my office one day, and I was going to direct a script of his, somewhat about his own life, called ER. And we were developing ER as a movie, and I was working on that, and we were taking a break, and I said, so Michael, what else are you doing? You know, what novels do you have in the pipeline? He says, well, I'm doing something that's kind of a big secret, and you know, I love when they say it's a big secret. I spent the next hour trying to get Michael to tell me the secret, and he finally said, well, if you don't tell anybody, which I never did, he said, I'm writing a novel about dinosaurs and DNA. That's all he gave me. And I got it. I just sort of got it. And I said, you mean they're coming back? He said, yeah, they're coming back. And I said, please, let me be the first person to read the novel. And he did. He let me read the novel because he wouldn't sell it to me as a producer. He said, if you direct it, it's yours. If you guarantee you'll direct it, he sold. He gave it to me as a director. Universal bought the rights. And then the screenplay ER was pushed off into the... wait and see box, and I made Jurassic Park. And the weird thing is, about a year later or so, we dusted ER off and sold it to NBC, and it became a television series. Well, the biggest obstacle was how to do the dinosaurs. At first, I was going to do the dinosaurs the old Ray Harryhausen way, which is, you know, stop motion, you know, armature claymation figures, you know, one frame at a time, the way King Kong and you know, the Sinbad movies were made. And I was willing to accept that because I had the greatest animator in the world working on Jurassic Park, a man named Phil Tippett, who was a genius at go motion, or stop motion as it was once known. And then Dennis Muren at ILM said, you know, I'm working on something based on something that you guys actually started, which was the first CGI shot ever put in a movie, which was on a film I produced and Barry Levinson directed, called Young Sherlock Holmes, where this image of a stained glass knight jumps out of the stained glass window with a sword and accosts this priest. And he said, since Jim Cameron did Terminator and The Abyss with those miraculous CGI elements, I think I can create a complete CGI animal, a T-Rex, and any dinosaur you want, but give me a chance to do this. And Dennis went into the lab and began experimenting up there in Northern California and came back one day and showed me for the first time the first test of a CGI animal. And it was phenomenal. And I think, you know, that the movie and all of my aspirations for it, you know, just sort of turned on a dime. And it became a different movie because of that.
It's a dinosaur.
You did it. You crazy son of a bitch, you did it.
Stephen has a gift which many people don't talk about, which is doing voices. But he kept a megaphone with him, and through sequences when a dinosaur is supposed to be there but actually isn't there, he would do the sounds for us. And I tease him to this day about it, because that's one of my favorite memories on the movie, is I'd be in a specific moment and something's about to appear and I'm supposed to feel the utmost terror a human being can ever feel in their life, and I'd hear roar, roar in the background. But he was proud of those sounds.
There was something that I had a very strong feeling about in the original, in the book and in the script. There was a scene, you know, where the T-Rex attacks, and my character kind of does what the lawyer's character does. I also get horribly frightened and skitter out of the car and go away, and Sam Neill's left there and to save the kids. I said, geez, I wish my character didn't have to do that. I wish, because we've already seen the lawyer do that, and my character is kind of cool and kind of da-da-da-da-da. Maybe I could do something particularly heroic there, even. What if I... And he said, I kind of described it, and then he said, well, show me on the day. And on the day, I kind of showed him, here it is, I was ready to act it all out, and he said, yeah, I like that better. Let's do that. So, in fact, and it's in the movie, I sort of see the dinosaur, and And I get his attention. I use myself as a decoy, and I kind of sacrifice myself to get him away from Sam and the kids.
Hey, Ian, freeze! Get the kids!
The investors. I want all of them.
Yes, sir.
Fisher. Ishmael Fisher.
Ishmael.
Toshev.
One
Sheriff.
Moment, sir. I'm sorry, sir.
Come on, Stan. Sheriff. The children. All the children. How many?
400.
450. More.
Schindler's List would mark a major turning point in Spielberg's career. It was a project he waited 10 years to direct. It was a movie he felt he had to make to pay honor not only to Oscar Schindler, but to all those who lost their lives in the Holocaust. The film was difficult to watch because of its subject matter. But Spielberg's thoughtful and skillful direction brought to the screen the heart-pounding images of one of the world's greatest crimes against humanity in a way that made audiences respond to and understand the tragedy that had taken place. The year was 1993. The year Schindler's List took home the Academy Award for Best Picture and a well-deserved Oscar for its director. Stephen also was awarded a Golden Globe as Best Director, as well as the London Critics Circle Award as Director of the Year, and the coveted Directors Guild Award for Outstanding Direction, and the British Academy Award as Best Director.
Well, Schindler's List took me over a decade to do simply because I recognize its importance. I recognize also the extreme damage that could do if it was not made right. If it didn't equip the experiences of the Holocaust survivors with honor and remembrance, then it would do more harm than good. And so the responsibility for me was daunting, so daunting it put me off the project for almost 10 years until I was, I guess, emotionally ready. I've often said I had to grow up, I had to have a kid, which I had 3 years after Sid Sheinberg bought the novel for me. I had my first child was born, and I think I grew up overnight. And the film began to have more importance to me because it was something I wanted to leave behind for my kids. So when they said, "Dad, what did you do that I could be proud of?" Instead of saying, "Well, all these big gothic audience entertainments," I could say, "Here's a piece of history you should know about. This is something that happened to our people and to all people." And that's probably why it took me that long to make the movie.
It was the first time that Stephen had never used a storyboard. And he was very raw, very vulnerable, and quite frightened. You know, the whole crew would be there, extras, hundreds of people, and he'd say, "Right, where am I going to put this camera? How do I start?" And then once he started, it was like I likened him to an abstract painter. Once he had the first dab of color on, then he just went. And you really had to try and keep up with him, you know.
Stephen was instrumental in helping me create the character, I think, because I based a lot of my character on Stephen. That's how instrumental he was. He trusts the intuition of the actor. And all this anger, which you can see coming out of me now, came out of me in Krakow, and Stephen just helped me point it in the right direction there. And I say just because that is his touch. His touch is absolutely magic. It's almost invisible.
SS contacts, list lower drawer of my desk. Would you handle his cash contributions to legitimate charities sent, of course, through each official's office? Dealings with our black market contacts listed as suppliers in the legitimate ledger are
forget
more
it.
Complicated. What do you mean? Forget it. You
it gives
can't
me a
forget
headache.
It. You
it
can't
gives
forget
me a headache.
It.
Director, don't let things fall apart. I worked too hard.
None of us had an obvious, easy path to tread. And on a daily basis, he would somehow tune into all the different temperatures of our temperaments on that day, where we were emotionally and creatively, and use it. And I remember when he was pleased, he would turn to the person standing next to him. And once I was watching a scene being filmed, and it was me, because I wasn't in the scene. I was watching someone else work, and I was standing next to Stephen. And he turned and whispered, "That's in the movie." And his phrase, "That's in the movie," is the greatest accolade, the greatest tribute he can pay to your work. That is there. That's in the movie. Now, when you are in a Steven Spielberg movie, then you know that you're probably in one of the most memorable films of the 20th century, or the most memorable ever. So to be told, "What you've just done is going to be in my movie, that's in the movie, Ben," is pretty thrilling.
He was subsumed by Schindler's List. And he talked about it a lot. I know when he went to bed at night, he would tell us the next morning he would be editing the film in his head. And always thinking of stuff, always that creative process never really shut down, you know?
I think Schindler's List is the best film I've ever made. And I'm happy about that. I'm really happy I'm able to say and admit that I've made a picture that's better than anything else I think I've ever made.
Perhaps the greatest honor of all came when Spielberg received the National Merit Cross, Germany's highest civil honor. German President Roman Herzog paid tribute to Spielberg by stating that Spielberg had contributed to a new discussion of the Holocaust in Germany.
It was a great honor that the film stimulated conversation everywhere in the world about the Holocaust, and also allowed me to create the Survivors of the Shoah Foundation, where we've already achieved, I think, 50,000 survivors on videotape testimony that will be, you know, disseminated someday in schools and Holocaust museums, and colleges and high schools around the world.
I could have got more. I could have got more. I don't know if I just... I could have got more.
Oscar, there are 1,100 people who are alive because of you. Look at them.
If I'd made more money... I threw away so much money. You have no idea. If I just...
There will be generations because of what you did.
I didn't do enough.
You did so much.
Amistad, the true story of an 1839 mutiny on board a slave ship, was released in 1997. For his work, he was nominated for a Golden Globe Award for Best Director and the Directors Guild Award for Outstanding Directorial Achievement. It was producer Debbie Allen who vigorously pursued Spielberg and eventually convinced him that he had to direct the film.
Well, it's just that Debbie Allen kept saying the same thing to me over and over again. Oh, Stephen, you've got to make this movie. You've got to make this movie. And she kept finding different ways of talking me into it. And she finally said, you have to make the movie for your black kids, because she knew I had two black children, two African-American kids. And she was right. I really did make this film for Theo and Michaela.
His first reaction was just this insatiable appetite for the history of it. He wanted to know about the people. He wanted to know who were the Africans, what was their religion, what kind of songs did they sing, had they ever seen white people, you know, what was going on in the Supreme Court, where were we historically with the abolition of slavery, how many years were we before the Civil War?
Yeah, I thought it was a story that had to be told. I thought it was also a very compelling piece of American hyphenate African history. Very, very compelling story. And I'm really attracted not by messages as much as I'm attracted by good stories. And I don't care where the story takes place or who's it's about. If I find a good story that really, you know, won't lay off me, won't leave me alone, then I can't leave it alone. I have to make the movie out of it.
We won't be going in there alone.
Alone? Indeed not. No, we have right at our side. We have righteousness at our side. We have Mr. Baldwin over there.
I meant my ancestors. I will call into the past. Far back to the beginning of time. And beg them to come and help me. At the judgment. I will reach back and draw them into me. And they must come. For at this moment, I am the whole reason they have existed at all.
Stephen could probably have been a writer or half a dozen other things, but he never, I don't think he's ever thought of anything else but film since he was 8 or 9 years old, you know. So it's in his genes, it's inbred, you know, and so clear when you're with him on set.
I'm neither friend nor foe of the abolitionist cause. No, I won't have you.
Sir.
What?
I know you, Mr. President. I know you and your presidency as well as any man, and your father's. You were a child at his side when he helped invent America. And you, in turn, have devoted your life to refining that noble invention. There remains but one task undone. One vital task the founding fathers left to their sons before their 13 colonists could precisely be called United States. And that task, sir, as you well know, is crushing slavery. Your record confirms you're an abolitionist, sir. Even if you won't. And whether or not you admit it.
Mr. Jones,
You belong with us.
You want to explain the math of this to me? I mean, where's the sense of risking the lives of the eight of us to save one guy?
20 degrees. Anybody want to answer that?
Driver, think about the poor bastard's mother.
Hey, Doc, I got a mother, all right? I mean, you got a mother. Sarge has got a mother. I mean, I bet even the captain's got a mother.
Tom Hanks headed the cast of the 1998 release of Saving Private Ryan, the World War II story of the Army's efforts to safely return home Private James Ryan after three of his brothers are killed in action. The film has been hailed by critics and veterans alike as the most realistic war movie ever made. The first 25 minutes contain some of the most harrowing and accurately recreated battle footage ever shot for a fiction film. Spielberg received an Academy Award as Best Director, and the film was nominated as Best Picture. The Directors Guild once again bestowed upon him the DGA Award for Outstanding Directorial Achievement.
Well, it was sort of a tribute and honor to my dad, who had all my life told me about his experiences in World War II as a radio operator on a B-25 in Burma. And he inspired me. I mean, he was always saying, when are you going to make a real World War II picture? But it also was an opportunity to acquit the experiences of those World War II and Korean War and Vietnam War and Desert Storm veterans to make this a movie for soldiers, for veterans. And I was, Tom Hanks and I were more concerned about honoring them and getting them to approve of our picture than anybody else. And I really wanted to make it as realistic as the experiences that they were communicating to me, and I just did my best to kind of tell their story the way they told me their stories.
I remember being down on the very first day of shooting any brand of combat on the film, and it was in the landing craft, and I was back in the back with the other actor. Stephen was behind us looking towards the bluff with all the camera crew. And I knew a lot of stuff had been rigged and whatnot, and I knew that it was going to be something that was going to be off the beaten path. I mean, you read in the script that, you know, the screenplay literally states that the front end goes down on the landing craft and the first row of guys are mowed down. And that's what you read.
I'll see you on the beach.
Then, in front of me, I saw literally guys blown to bits. And the pieces of human beings, you know, representative human beings, that were flying through the air. And some of the air was pink with mist that I knew was representative of the blood that was going down. And just what I saw in the back, from my eyes, never mind what the camera was seeing, was horrifying.
It was horrendously difficult because it was... Well, it was awful. I mean, it was awful to see it. I mean, none of us got used to the sights. You know, we'd come onto the sands. We were shot Omaha Beach, you know, for a little while. It was County Wexford Island where we shot the Omaha Beach landings. And that was the toughest part of the film. The first 25 minutes and the last 25 minutes, the final battle and the opening battle were the two hardest parts of that picture, obviously, to put on film honestly. And I think if it weren't for Schindler's List, I would not had a way into the telling of that story, because Schindler's List gave me courage about the documentary approach to filmmaking, as opposed to the slick Dolly Tracks Chapman Crane approach to filmmaking, which I had used in all my other pictures. And I left all those tools behind on Schindler's List, and I said, you know, I think I'm going to take a lesson from Schindler's List. I'm going to shoot Private Ryan the same way a combat cameraman shot World War II, as low to the ground And as safely out of harm's way as possible, getting shots when he could, and with a very shaky camera. And which is exactly all the documentary footage any of us have ever seen about actual combat. It's never slick and CB DeMille. It's extremely, rough and almost dirty.
Stephen had always pledged that he was never going to work under a bald sky. There was always going to have to be clouds there. And he was prepared to go off to Ireland and wait for the weather to turn as bad as he needed it to be bad. But Stephen being Stephen, he knew that mystery was going to play itself out on our faces, and it did. I'd gone back and see. It's still one of the most palpable, you know, weeks of movie making that I can recall. I can still go back and look at these scenes. It's like it's the scene where the little girl was handed down from the bombed out house, and when Caparso was killed by the sniper. We were all just absolutely Absolutely, Mrs. Lemon. Probably took 3 days to shoot.
Okay. I can't. She reminds me of my niece, sir.
Capoison, get the kids back up there.
Captain, the decent thing to do is to at least take her down the road to the next town.
We're not here to do the decent thing. We're here to follow orders.
We were all sort of directors in one way or another on the movie. There were like five of us who tried to direct films at one point. And Matt Damon, I understand, one day he tried to stand right next to Steven and stay with him all day long, watch what he does, see how he does the job, be privy to every conversation, and follow him wherever he went. And he was exhausted by lunchtime. He had to give it up because Steven was always jumping on a forerunner and heading off to having some meeting in back with the armorers, and then he was going off to the editing room in order to watch him cut footage, and then he was coming back in order to line up the shot, and then he was going into a trailer in order to have a phone call, and he wore him right into the ground. And we all looked at each other and said, you know, maybe we should all rethink this concept of being directors, because I don't know if I can work that hard.
In his career, Spielberg has been honored with the 1987 Irving G. Thalberg Award. ShowWest selected him as Director of the Year, both in 1982 and 1994. In 1993, the Venice Film Festival gave him the Golden Lion Award for his career achievements. The Southeastern Film Critics Association honored him with their Best Director Award for Saving Private Ryan. The National Society of Film Critics honored him twice as Best Director for E.T. and Schindler's List. The Los Angeles Critics Association voted him Best Director for both E.T. and Saving Private Ryan. The Broadcast Critics Association bestowed upon him the Best Director Award for Saving Private Ryan. He was given a Lifetime Achievement Award in 1995 by the American Film Institute. And the list goes on.
I think one of the greatest pleasures one gets from working with Steven is to see the delight on his face when you've surprised him. And when that goes, we've lost him. And when we lose him, that would be a great shame.
Well, I just get a lot of ideas about movies I want to make. I love telling stories. And, you know, when I get tired of telling stories, you know, publicly telling stories, then I'll retire from that and I'll tell stories to my kids. I'll continue telling them privately. But I don't think that'll ever happen. I just like, I love doing this job. It's a great job to have, you know, when I can, you know, be a part of somebody else's dream and putting that dream on the screen, or if I can get an idea from my, you know, naked brain in the middle of the night and write it down on the back of a, you know, piece of paper, and 18 months later, whatever's on the back of that piece of paper is a big movie or a small movie. I mean, that is the stuff that makes all of us want to, you know, work in this business and create and have fun. You know, what makes me want to direct as opposed to makes me want to produce is just how hard the tug is in here. You know, I mean, it has to tug me to want to put my name on anything or get involved in anything. The films I make here at DreamWorks, I've got to say, wow, what a good story. I want to share that. People should see this movie. But if it really pulls me, I know that difference. It's a bigger tickle. You know, that gets me to say, I'm not giving this away. I'm keeping this for myself. That's a much bigger tickle.